ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays on ABC Radio National.
We did try to stay weekly, but global events, well, they're coming too thick and fast.
And now we're delivering 5 days a week.
The issues, the challenges are serious, but our aim always is to make it a conversation we can all share. I'm Hamish McDonald.
I'm Geraldine Doogue, and now joined by esteemed colleagues Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Global Roaming, weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and on the ABC Listen app.
On the 28th of January 1986, just like any other day of the week, 34-year-old Leslie Ebling was in the car with her dad, Bob. Leslie, her dad, and three workmates were carpooling to an engineering plant in Promontory in Utah. But Leslie's dad wasn't his usual self.
He was driving that day and he was beating his hand on the steering wheel and saying, they're going to kill him. They're going to die. And that was the basic premise of the whole thing. And that he didn't do enough. That he couldn't talk anybody into believing that he knew what he was talking about. And he was swerving in and out of people. And so angry. And I wondered if he were going to get to work alive because he was driving really reckless.
The engineering company where Leslie and Bob worked was Morton Thiokol. And Morton Thiokol had built the solid rocket boosters, those enormous white pillars set on each side of the space shuttle that would give it enough thrust to reach orbit for 2 minutes every launch.
And Bob Ebling had been deeply involved in the design, development and testing of these solid rocket boosters, in particular, the O-rings. So that morning, Morton Thiokol staff gathered in a conference room to watch the next launch of the Space Shuttle Challenger, the Teacher in Space launch.
Well, the five engineers were there, plus upper management.
For the engineers, the atmosphere was tense because they had serious concerns that the launch would fail.
I sat down in front of my dad, and it was very, very quiet. You know, there wasn't a lot of talking going on. It was so eerie. But once it launched and got past the pad, he bent down and whispered in my ear and he said, it's not over yet.
When I saw it explode, I couldn't believe it. I don't know why. I just couldn't believe that it happened. And I stayed and saw the replay of it, and I realized that, oh, this is real.
Brian Russell was one of the engineers in the room that day.
We just all felt the same way, and we felt awful. And it wasn't like we were trying to console each other, because there wasn't any consolation to be given.
He just put his hands down in his face, and he just started crying. He sobbed.
This is The Challenger Legacy, a five-part series of science fiction from ABC Radio National. I'm Dr. Carl.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. Episode 2, Five Lepers.
In the days after the Challenger exploded, some 73 seconds into the launch, President Ronald Reagan launched an investigation into the cause of the disaster.
It's time now to assemble a group of distinguished Americans to take a hard look at the accident, to make a calm and deliberate assessment of the facts and the ways to avoid repetition.
This wasn't supposed to happen. This was huge. Everybody wanted to know what had happened and how and why.
People right around the world were trying to figure that out.
What do we know about the explosion the other day? Please welcome our man of science, Karl Kruzelnitsky.
So that's the great Australian journalist Ray Martin, and he's speaking to a very, very young Dr. Carl. Carl, you were asked what you thought could have been the cause of the Challenger disaster on that day.
Well, NASA's not speaking. They're saying we're going to wait until we get all of the data in. I've got my own theory. If we could roll the footage, we could see some of it. Oh, well, as it's going up, you can see those long, skinny cylinders on the side. They're the solid boosters. They're basically like a firecracker. You light them and then they just go. And you can see in the still that they're putting out much more smoke than those little flames on the back of the space shuttle engines. And my theory is that it's because they put out so much more energy that perhaps they developed a crack and then flame spurred out of those solid boosters into the space shuttle and it caused it to explode. But, of course, NASA's not saying. They're doing the sensible thing and they're waiting until they get all the data in.
Wow. Give us some background here. What was going on? How close was I back then?
So your theory was pretty close. But to understand it, we need to understand those solid rocket boosters that you mentioned a bit earlier.
Ah, so the SRBs, the solid rocket boosters, those are the things that propelled the space shuttle. In the first 2 minutes of flight, they provided about 80% of the thrust. They were absolutely essential. And then the main engines would continue and take the orbiter up the rest of the way to 400 kilometres up and travelling at around 28,000 kilometres per hour.
And these SRBs, or solid rocket boosters, were gigantic.
So the solid rocket boosters were remarkable because they were the largest solid rockets ever built. They were, when completed, 15 stories high. And they were, in fact, so large that they could not be built in a single monolithic stack.
So that's journalist Adam Higginbotham again. He's the author of the 2024 book Challenger.
The Thiokol design required them to be built, therefore, in separate sections, which could be transported across the country by rail and then put together into a completed rocket only when they reached Cape Canaveral.
And joining each of these solid rocket booster, that's SRB sections, together, there were the O-rings and the joints in which they sat. Now, if you've heard anything about the Challenger disaster before, you probably remember there was something about the O-rings. These O-rings, they were 3.8 metres in diameter. That's as wide as the body of the rocket booster, but they were as thin as your little finger, just 7 millimetres thick. And that O-ring was supposed to take the flexing as this enormous thrust that was absolutely essential to shove it into orbit rippled through the stack. But this enormous stack also made the SRB flex a little bit this way and that. And so the O-rings absolutely had to remain flexible.
Yes, these joints and O-rings were crucial.
The O-rings were required to seal the joints between the sections of the solid rockets at the moment of ignition. They were designed to prevent hot gases, which burned at a temperature of in excess of 6,500 degrees Fahrenheit, from escaping from inside the combustion chamber of the rocket. Because if they did, and they reached the metal casing of the rocket, which was made of steel, which is about half an inch thick, you know, even the smallest finger of hot gas, something, you know, smaller than the width of a pencil, would just cut through the casing like a knife through butter, and would then, you know, cut open the casing. And very quickly after that, the rocket would just completely disintegrate, either on the launch pad or in flight.
That was exactly what happened in the Challenger disaster. At launch, the O-ring did not seal correctly. And that meant that during the flight, hot gas and then flame blew past the O-rings in one of the joints on the right-hand solid rocket booster, and that inevitably tore the shuttle apart.
Okay, so that was the mechanical failure that destroyed the Space Shuttle Challenger. But for me, the really key thing about this story is not just that mechanical failure. It's the how and the why it failed, and whether anybody could have stopped it failing if a certain group of engineers were listened to. And that's what we're about to get into. Because here's the kicker. The performance of the O-rings was a known concern well before January 28th, 1986.
So, do you remember when you first heard about concerns around the O-rings?
It was probably a year that he started, and the other guys in the carpool were all engineers. And so they talked about it, and Dad would say things like, you know what, we've got trouble. I just listened to what they said.
So that's Leslie Ebling again. Her dad worked on the O-rings, and she worked in the comms department at Morton Thiokol.
There was growing concern over a year, and he wasn't getting any help. You know, it was NASA's on a schedule. We don't care. It was really upsetting for him. I mean, the last year before the incident, he was very serious.
So what was his concern with the O-ring?
That they cracked. There were cracks in them. And he said, these people are sitting on a bomb.
The whole program was aware of the erosion problem after STS-2, which was in November 1981.
Okay, so that's Brian Russell. And Leslie's dad, Bob Ebling, was his boss at Morton Thiokol. Brian was probably the most junior of that dedicated O-ring team.
They were all old enough to be my father.
And now he's the last of a group of five key engineers who worked on the O-rings who's still alive.
So you're saying that people like Bob and Brian were aware of this problem with the O-rings well before the Challenger actually blew up?
Basically, for the entire extent of the space shuttle program, there was an awareness of this problem with the O-rings, and this team was trying to fix it. But the space shuttles continued to launch. And there was this one key launch I want to focus on that happened 12 months before the Challenger disaster, which really rattled the team.
The launch that happened a year before Challenger in January of 1985 was very alarming when the joints were pulled apart. The damage to the O-ring was not as deep as other O-ring erosion depths that we had seen, but the sooting was far more massive, and there was evidence that some of the soot got behind the primary O-ring.
They knew this was going on because, like many of the parts of the space shuttle, these parts were used over and over again?
Yes. So when the solid rocket boosters, the SRBs, were pulled out of the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Florida, they got to have a really good look at them. So January 1985... another member of the team from Morton Thiokol, his name was Roger Beaujolais, he was shocked at the level of erosion on these O-rings from that particular launch.
Roger himself was down there and inspected that joint, and there was nothing of significant difference other than the temperature that day. That was the coldest temperature launch that we had had in the program up to that point.
Ah, the temperature could be a factor. Okay, so that January 1985 space shuttle launch happened during what was dubbed Florida's Freeze of the Century?
And that was when the engineers developed a new theory that cold outside temperatures worsened this O-ring issue.
Can you describe what the cold temperature does to the O-ring?
O-rings are made out of a synthetic rubber. And they squeeze. And so just like any rubber piece, you can put them between your fingers and squeeze them. Although this rubber is fairly hard, even at room temperature, it's squeezable. And when you make it cold, number one, you shrink it. Number two, you make it harder. But number three, which was the most concerning to us, is a feature that we called resiliency and the capability of the O-ring to have an internal spring after it's squeezed down and to spring back is severely hampered by lower temperatures.
Okay, Fee, so how cold was that January 1985 launch compared to the Challenger disaster 1 year later in 86, the one that blew up?
The temperature at the time of launch in 1985 was 12 degrees Celsius. At that point, this was the coldest ever launch. But the forecast for launch a year later was minus 3 degrees Celsius. So on January 27, a day before the launch of the Teacher in Space mission, when they saw the freezing cold forecast, Morton Thiokol engineers set up a series of meetings with NASA. They were worried that these even colder temperatures could cause a catastrophic failure.
From ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Challenger Legacy, a special series of science fiction.
When he found out that they were going to launch it on that day, he called his boss, who was already down in Florida. His name was Al McDonald. So he called Al and he said, we can't launch.
That's Leslie Ebling again, the daughter of Bob Ebling.
He said, it's going to be a catastrophic event. So Al tried to talk somebody into listening. And then they had a meeting the night before the launch.
So, V, what happened in this teleconference, bearing in mind that today, talking to somebody and seeing their face is nothing, but back then, a teleconference was a big deal?
Absolutely. So the engineers presented data to NASA and to Morton Thiokol Management, which showed the impact of cold temperatures on the O-rings. They were worried that this could be the day that the O-rings would finally fail, because it was just so cold. And they recommended that NASA not go ahead with the launch of the mission. Brian Russell, our engineer, was at this meeting.
My recollection was that Larry Malloy made an argument against it. He did not accept the recommendation. He felt that the data did not justify that recommendation.
So Larry Malloy was NASA's solid rocket booster project manager at the time. He wanted the launch to go ahead, and he famously said that night,
"When do you want me to launch, Thiokol? Next April?" And he said it in an elevated voice. I just remember when he said that, I was just struck. It was very sharp, and I didn't understand why he would feel that way, even though the data were conflicting. I was still stung by what he said, and I think most people in that room were. And so that was a real turning point.
What do you think the aim of that comment was? What was he trying to do?
The aim of Larry's comment, in my view, was to discredit our justification for delay. And, you know, as I thought about it, even at that night, I thought that was just full of hyperbole, because there's no doubt that the temperature in 1 or 2 days, the temperature in Florida would be back up to the mid-70s and everything would be just fine. And we would be within the temperature range that we normally launched. And then George Hardy mentioned that he was appalled at our recommendation. And that was another comment that just stung.
Fee, this is an astonishing bit of dialogue that I'm hearing here. There's a mention of George Hardy. Now, can you tell me about George Hardy?
At the time, George Hardy was the Deputy Director of Engineering at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. He's a very senior figure to have on that call.
And I think those types of comments turned the tide of accepting the launch at whatever temperature we might see.
Morton Thiokol asked for a 5-minute break from this call to discuss what had been said. And the engineers just kept going back to the data.
They got quite emotional about it. And finally, our general manager, Jerry Mason, said, "We've plowed this ground already." And then he pulled his vice presidents, of which there were three below him. One was his assistant. He wasn't very closely involved in the program at all. He immediately said yes. And then Al's boss, Joe Kilminster, agreed to launch. And then he turned to Bob Lund, who was the head of engineering, who had been involved in the development of our rationale through the whole day. And Bob hummed and hawed. And he was in a real tough position. Here he had three of the leaders of the company saying that it's okay to launch. And he had his engineers who had said, no, it's not. But as he was hesitating to answer, that's when Jerry Mason said to him, "Bob, it's time to take off your engineering hat and put on your management hat."
Oh, forget the engineering. Let's just go with, what was the other hat he said?
Management.
Oh.
Put your management hat on.
Oh.
Mm. So eventually, Morton Thiokol rejoined the conference call, and unanimously, management say that they approved the launch. Now, this is a complete reversal on the position of the company from 1 hour before. And in order to launch, NASA needs approval from all three of its major contractors. So if Morton Thiokol had withheld their approval, Challenger could not have launched. And one of the key engineers, his name was Al McDonald, did actually refuse to put his signature on the decision. He said he wouldn't sign off on it. Someone stepped in to do it in his place.
Wow, okay, so the management type engineers overruled the engineer type engineers, and so they've got their approval from their third major contractor. So they got the approval, so the path is clear for the Teacher in Space mission, I guess, to go ahead.
My biggest regret in the whole episode was I just wish I'd have said when we were back on live mic, after our general manager said that we're go for launch, I wish I'd have said that there's a dissenting opinion here. And I just so regret not having said that, which I don't know if it would have changed anything, but it would have caused other people to say, yeah, me too, and that we don't agree with what's happening here. And I don't know if a groundswell would have changed anything, but having not done it, the people at Marshall thought that we in Utah were unanimous, and we were not.
What do you think it was that stopped you from saying something?
I have thought about that a lot, and some of it was fear. Some of it was a resignation that the decision had been made and that it was a done deal. And some of the justification of, well, what good would it have done? But I think it was a combination of those feelings. And one of the things that I came out of that with is I said, I'm never going to be in that position again. I am never going to be afraid to speak up when I believe that a different view needs to be expressed.
Well, of course, with the wisdom of hindsight, we know what happened next.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd planned to speak to you tonight to report on the State of the Union. But the events of earlier today have led me to change those plans. Today is a day for mourning and remembering. Nancy and I are pained to the core by the tragedy of the Shuttle Challenger. We know we share this pain with all of the people of our country.
So now you've heard what was happening behind the scenes in the lead up to the launch. But at the time, the only people who knew any of this were the people on that teleconference. Sure, the technical cause started to become clear, the O-rings and the SRBs, and as far as the public were concerned, maybe that was because of shoddy engineering at Morton Thiokol?
Yeah, it took a little longer for the public to get the full picture.
This is 1986. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have computers.
So that's Howard Berkus. At the time, he was a reporter with NPR. And after the disaster, he got a tip that the engineers working at Morton Thiokol hadn't wanted the shuttle to launch that day, but they'd been overruled. So no mobile phone, no computer. He heads to Brigham City in Utah, where most of the Morton Thiokol staff lived, and he gets started.
And so we started knocking on doors. I knocked on one door and, you know, 10 or 20 business cards from reporters from all over the world fell out of the crack in the door. I wasn't the only one doing this. But one door did open up. Bob Ebling wasn't home, but his wife was.
What happened was Howard Berkus from NPR, he was standing out in the yard because there were people that were milling around in front of my dad's house. And my dad said, now don't talk to my mom. Don't talk to anyone. Don't let anyone in. Well, my mom lets Howard in.
I asked if I could use the phone to call my editor in Washington. Again, we don't have cell phones. I hadn't talked to her all day. And she was very kind and she let me in. And after the phone call, we sat and chatted for a while and she gave me something to drink. And then Bob walked in the front door.
So my dad walks in from work and there's Howard sitting there.
And he was not happy at all to see a reporter sitting at their kitchen table. But he was also frantic, energized, upset, and he couldn't stop talking. And he was pacing back and forth. He was wringing his hands because the night before he saw in the newspaper a picture of the railroad overpass that all Thiokol workers went under as they drove out to the facility out in the desert. And somebody had scrawled on there, Morton Thiokol murderers. And he felt really unfairly blamed, and Thiokol was unfairly blamed for what happened with Challenger. And he kept wanting to tell the story of what actually happened.
Fee, that is really heavy to see above where you go to work each day. Morton, Thiokol, murderers. Wow. And you're just an engineer.
Exactly. Then Bob Ebeling wanted to share his side of the story, but he didn't want to lose his job.
Dad went into some detail with him, but he didn't, you know, he said, you can never mention my name. Don't know me. This is, you know, you've got to keep it secret.
And of course, he didn't want to be identified. He feared that he would be fired if he was identified. They were ordered not to say anything. They were ordered to refer any questions, you know, to the public relations machinery there at Thiokol. Thiokol was desperately trying to control the narrative that came out of their facility.
And meanwhile, one of Howard's colleagues is speaking to another Morton Thiokol engineer.
Well, I'm in Bob Ebeling's kitchen in Utah. Danny's Wordling, simultaneously, and neither of us know that this is happening, is knocking on the hotel room door of Roger Beaujolais. And Beaujolais, at first, only spoke through the door. And Danny could hear him crying through the door. And he didn't want to talk. But Danny convinced him that the only way that the real story would come out is if he would talk about it.
So both accounts of Roger Beaujolais and Bob Ebeling from the night before the launch are identical, but neither of the engineers are prepared to go on tape. So Howard and Daniel read their matching accounts on the 20th of February 1986 for NPR's Morning Edition.
This is Howard Berkus in Brigham City, Utah. A Morton Thiokol engineer here says he prayed as he watched Shuttle Challenger lift off from its launch pad. We can't tell you his name, his job title, or even the color of his hair. His job may depend on this secrecy. But we can tell you something of what he feels, what others may feel about the right stuff going awry.
Reagan's presidential inquiry shifted from a focus on the mechanical failure to the human failure. All five of our concerned engineers gave evidence.
There were some very serious and heavy names on this commission. People with inside knowledge and deep theoretical and practical knowledge. So, Sally Ride, the first American woman to fly into space. Richard Feynman, that absolutely brilliant theoretical physicist. And Neil Armstrong, the first person ever to walk on the moon.
And in the end, after this four-month investigation, the commission found...
The official report on the explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger has found mismanagement in the U.S. Space Agency contributed heavily to the disaster. Richard Palfreyman reports.
This 250-page report is highly critical of the way NASA decided to go ahead with the ill-fated Challenger flight, despite the warnings that the booster rockets might malfunction in the cold weather. One commission member described that decision-making as a kind of Russian roulette, and as a result, the Rogers Commission has recommended a complete overhaul of NASA's management structure.
Wow, that's a major finding to come out with. And I kind of have a bit of sympathy for NASA because they're running on a year-to-year budget and they're always crawling for funds. So were there any repercussions against those five engineering-type engineers? I mean, they're engineers-type engineers. I love them to pieces. Any repercussions against them?
Yes, there were. So Brian, Roger Beaujolais, Bob Ebeling, Al McDonald and Arnie Thompson, our engineers from Morton Thiokol, they were all essentially sidelined by management, at least for a little while. And they actually came to call themselves the Five Lepers.
That was a term that I recall Bob Ebeling to have coined. And he was a pretty clever guy. I loved him. He was one of my favorite bosses. And he was quite outspoken because of the testimony that we gave, that we felt that even the decision, after all the arguments were given, was still the wrong decision. And of course, a lot of people would look at us and say, well, that's easy to say after the fact.
Did you continue to work for Morton Thiokol?
I decided to stay. I was very young. I had the majority of my career in front of me. And there was a large part of me that wanted to be part of the solution. So I elected to stay. I know that some of the others of the five, like Bob Ebeling, for example, and Roger Beaujolais, they retired early. It ate them up.
He felt so responsible. You know, we all told him, everyone told him, you did what you could do. His boss told him, you know, you did the best you could do. But it wasn't good enough in his eyes. You know, he didn't save anybody. It was horrible.
The 4 months after that incident, in my mind's eye, right in my forehead, I could not get the image out of my mind of that exploding vehicle. And I was depressed. I was angry. I was irritable. I was a lousy husband and a father at that time. And I wondered if I was ever going to come out of it. And I even talked with my wife about that, my concern. Finally, in about June, that fog started to clear. And it wasn't that I didn't still feel the guilt of being a part of it and not speaking up, but at least the immediate aftermath seemed to be behind me.
In the wake of the Challenge disaster, the space shuttle program came to a halt for more than 2 years as engineers like Brian Russell worked to fix the problem with the solid rocket boosters.
We poured a ton of resources into the redesign, and we came out of that redesign with me never having that white knuckle and turned stomach feeling at a launch. I just felt supremely confident that we were going to be successful, and because we did such a good job on the redesign.
But then, close to two decades after the Challenger explosion, history repeats itself.
The tragedy that cut short the lives of the seven crew members of the Columbia space shuttle just after 1 a.m. this morning, Australian Eastern Time, couldn't have come at a worse time for the Bush administration.
NASA faces another reckoning.
When you dig deep enough, there's no question that the organizational culture was implicated in both the Columbia and Challenger mishaps.
That's on the next episode of The Challenger Legacy.
Science Friction, The Challenger Legacy was made for ABC Radio National on the lands of the Gadigal and Menang Noongar people. It's reported and presented by me, Fiona Pepper.
And with me, Carl Krushelnitsky. The show's senior producer is James Bullen, and our sound engineer is Timothy Jenkins.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.